It was sleeting. Brother Pin and Sister Tulip slid and slithered through the freezing drops. Behind them, whistles were blowing in the murk. "Come on!" Pin yelled.
"These ing sacks are heavy!"
There were whistles blowing off to one side now, too. Mr. Pin wasn't used to this. Watchmen shouldn't be enthusiastic or organised. He'd been chased by watchmen before, when plans hadn't quite worked out. Their job was to give up at the second corner, out of breath. He felt quite angry about that. The watchmen here were doing it wrong. He was aware of an open space to one side of him, full of damp, swirling flakes. Below him there was a sluggish, sucking noise, like a very bad digestion. "This is a bridge. Chuck them in the river," he commanded.
"I thought we wanted to find..."
"Doesn't matter. Get rid of all of them. Right now, end of problem." Sister Tulip grunted a reply and skidded to a halt at the parapet. The two whining, yapping sacks went straight on over.
"Did that sound like a ing splash to you?"
said Sister Tulip, peering through the sleet. "Who cares? Now run!" Mr. Pin shivered as he sped on. He didn't know what had been done to him back there, but he'd felt like he'd walked over his own grave. He felt he had more than just watchmen after him. He speeded up. In reluctant but marvellous harmony, because no one could sing like a group of dwarfs, even if the song was "May I Suck of Water Pure," in other circumstances it would have been as likely as cows singing "Let Me Be Covered in Rapturous Gravy," the dwarfs seemed to be calming Otto down. Besides, the horrible black emergency blutwurst had finally been produced. For a vampire, this was the equivalent of a cardboard cigarette to a terminal nicotine addict, but it was at least something he could get his teeth into. When William finally tore his gaze away from the horror of the shadows, Saccharissa was mopping Otto's brow.
"Oh, once again, I am so ashamed. Where can I put my head? It's so..."
William held up the picture. "Otto, what's this?" In the shadows were mouths screaming. In the shadows were eyes wide. They didn't move while you watched them, but if you looked at the picture a second time, you got a feeling that they weren't quite in the same place. Otto shuddered.
"Oh, I used all the eels I had," he said.
"And?" "Oh, they're awful," breathed Saccharissa, looking away from the tortured shadows.
"I feel so wretched," said Otto. "Obviously they were too strong."
"Tell us, Otto."
"Well, the iconograph does not lie. You have heard this,
of course."
"Yes, well, under strong dark light, the picture really does not lie. Dark light reveals the truth to the dark eyes of the mind."
He paused and sighed.
"Ah, once again, no ominous roll of thunder, what a waste. But at least you could look apprehensively at the shadows."
All heads turned towards the shadows in the corner of the room and under the roof. They were simply shadows, haunted by nothing more than dust and spiders.
"But there's just dust and..."
Saccharissa began. Otto held up a hand.
"Dear lady, I have just told you. Philosophically, the truth can be what is metaphorically there."
William stared at the picture again.
"I had hoped that I could use filters and so on to cut down on the unwanted effects," said Otto behind him. "But alas..."
"This gets worse and worse," said Saccharissa. "It gives me the humorous vegetables." Good Mountain shook his head.
"This is unholy stuff," he said. "No more meddling with it, understand?"
"I didn't think dwarfs were religious," said William.
"We are not," said Good Mountain. "But we know unholy when we see it, and I'm looking at it right now. I'm telling you, I don't want any more of these prints of darkness."
William grimaced. "It shows the truth," he thought. "But how do we know the truth when we see it? The Ephebian philosophers think that a hare can never outrun a tortoise, and they can prove it. Is that the truth? I heard a wizard say that everything is made up of little numbers, whizzing around so fast that they become stuff. Is that true? I think a lot of things that have been happening over the last few days are not what they seem, and I don't know why I think that, but I think it's not the truth."
"Yes, no more of this stuff, Otto," he said.
"Damn right," said Good Mountain.
"Let's just try to get back to normal and get a paper out, shall we?" "You mean normal where mad priests start to collect dogs, or normal where vampires mess around with evil shadows?"
said Gowdy.
"I mean like normal before that," said William. "Oh, I see, you mean like back in the old days," said Gowdy.
After a while, though, silence settled on the press room, although there was an occasional sniff from the desk opposite. William wrote a story about the fire. That was easy. But then he tried to write a coherent account of the recent events, but found he couldn't get beyond the first word. He'd written the. It was a reliable word, the definite article. The trouble was, all the things he was definite about were bad. He'd expected to, what? Inform people, yes. Annoy people, well, some people at least. What he hadn't expected was that it wouldn't make any difference. The paper came out, and it didn't matter. People just seemed to accept things. What was the point of writing another story on the veterinary business? Well, of course, it had a lot of dogs in it, and there was always a lot of human interest in a story about animals. What did you expect? Said Saccharissa, as if she was reading his thoughts. Did you think people would be marching in the streets? Veterinari isn't a very nice man, from what I hear. People say he probably deserves to be locked up. Are you saying people aren't interested in the truth? Listen, what's true to a lot of people is that they need money for the rent by the end of the week. Look at Mr. Ron and his friends. What's the truth mean to them? They live under a bridge. She held up a piece of lined paper, crammed edge to edge with the careful looped handwriting of someone for whom holding a pen was not a familiar activity. This is a report of the annual meeting of the Ankh-Morpork Caged Bird Society, she said. They're just ordinary people who breed canaries and things as a hobby. Their chairman lives next door to me, which is why he gave me this. This stuff is important to him. My goodness, but it's dull. It's all about best of breed and some changes in the show rules about parrots, which they argued about for 2 hours. But the people who were arguing were people who mostly spend their day mincing meat or sawing wood and basically leading little lives that are controlled by other people. Do you see? They've got no say in who runs the city, but they can damn well see to it that cockatoos aren't lumped in with parrots. It's not their fault. It's how things are. Why are you sitting there with your mouth open like that? William closed his mouth. All right. I understand. No, I don't think you do, she snapped. I looked you up in Twerp's Peerage. Your family have never had to worry about the small stuff, have they? They've been some of the people who really run things. This paper is a kind of hobby for you, isn't it? Oh, you believe in it, I'm sure you do. But if it all goes wahoony-shaped, you'll still have money. I won't. So if the way it can be kept going is by filling it with what you sneer at as olds, then that's what I'll do. I don't have money. I make my own living. Yes, but you were able to choose. Anyway, aristocrats don't like to see other toffs starving. They find them silly jobs to do for serious wages. She stopped, panting, and pushed some hair out of her eyes. Then she looked at him like someone who has lit the fuse and is now wondering if the barrel at the other end is bigger than they thought. William opened his mouth, went to shape a word, and stopped. He did it again. Finally, a little hoarsely, he said, "You're more or less right." "The next word's going to be but, I just know it," said Saccharissa. William was aware that the printers were all watching. "Yes, it is. Aha. But it's a big but. Do you mind? It's important. Someone has to care about the big truth. What veterinary mostly does not do is a lot of harm. We've had rulers who are completely crazy and very, very nasty. And it wasn't that long ago, either. Veterinari might not be a very nice man, but I had breakfast today with someone who'd be a lot worse if he ran the city, and there are lots more like him. And what's happening now is wrong. And as for your damn parrot fanciers, if they don't care about anything much beyond things that go squawk in cages, then one day there'll be someone in charge of this place who'll make them choke on their own budgies. You want that to happen? If we don't make an effort, all they'll get is silly stories about talking dogs and elves ate my gerbil. So don't give me lectures on what's important and what's not. Understand? They glared at one another. Don't you talk to me like that. Don't you talk to me like that. We're not getting enough advertising. The Enquirer's getting huge adverts from the big guilds, said Saccharissa. That's what'll keep us going, not stories about how much gold weighs. What am I supposed to do about it? Find a way of getting more ads. That's not my job, William shouted. It's part of saving your job. We're just getting penny-a-line advertisements from people wanting to sell surgical supports and backache cures. So the pennies add up. So you want us to be known as the paper you can put your trust in?
Excuse me, but are we producing an edition? Said Goodmountain.
Not that we aren't enjoying all this, but the colour's going to take a lot of extra time.
William and Saccharissa looked round.
They were the focus of attention. "Look, I know this means a lot to you," said Saccharissa, lowering her voice, "but all this political stuff, this is the Watch's job, not ours, that's all I'm saying."
"They're stuck. That's what Vimes was telling me."
Saccharissa stared at his frozen expression. Then she leaned over and, to his shock, patted his head.
"Perhaps you are having an effect, then."
"Ha!"
"Well, if they're going to pardon Vetinari, maybe it's because they're worried about you."
"Ha!" "Anyway, who are they?"
"Well, you know, them. The people who run things. They notice things. They probably read the paper."
William gave her a wan smile. "Tomorrow we'll find someone to get more ads," he said. "And we'll definitely need those extra staff. I'm going to go for a little walk," he added. "And I'll get you that key."
"Key?
You wanted a dress for the ball?"
"Oh, yes, thank you."
"And I don't think those men will be back," said William. "I've got a feeling that there isn't a shed anywhere in town that's as well guarded as this one right at the moment."
"Because Vimes is waiting to see who tries to get at us next," he thought. But he decided not to say so.
"What exactly are you going to do?" said Saccharissa.
"First, I'm going to the nearest apothecary," said William. "And then I'm going to drop in at my lodgings for that key, and then I'm going to see a man about a dog."
The new firm hurtled through the door of the empty mansion and bolted it behind them. Mr. Tulip ripped off the Bride of Innocence outfit and hurled it on the floor.
"I told you, in clever plans never work," he said.
"A vampire," said Mr. Pin. "This is a sick city, Mr. Tulip."
"What was that he in did to us?"
"He took some kind of picture," said Mr. Pin.
He closed his eyes for a moment. His head was aching.
"Well, I was in disguise," said Mr. Tulip.
Mr. Pin shrugged. Even with a metal bucket over his head, which would probably begin to corrode after a few minutes, there would be something recognisable about Mr. Tulip.
"I don't think that will do any good," he said.
"I hate pictures," snarled Mr. Tulip. "Remember that time in Moldavia, all them posters they did? It's bad for a man's health seeing his ing fizz on every wall with dead or alive under it. It's like they can't ing decide."
Mr. Tulip fished out a small bag of what he had been assured was primo smudge, but which would turn out to be sugar and powdered pigeon guano.
"Anyway, we must have got the ing dog," he said.
"We can't be sure," said Mr. Pin. He winced again. The headache was getting quite strong.
"Look, we done that ing job," said Mr. Tulip. "I don't recall no one telling us about ing werewolves and vampires. That's their ing problem. I say we scrag the geek, take the money and head for Pseudopolis or someplace."
"You mean quit on a contract?"
"Yeah, when it's got small print you can't ing see."
"Someone will recognise Charlie, though. Seems it's hard for the dead to stay dead around here."
"I reckon I could help in that ing respect," said Mr. Tulip.
Mr. Pin chewed his lip. He knew better than Mr. Tulip that men in their business needed a certain reputation. Things didn't get written down, but the word got about. The new firm sometimes dealt with very serious players, and they were people who took a lot of notice of the word. But Tulip did have a point. This place was getting to Mr. Pin. It jarred his sensibilities. Vampires and werewolves. Springing that sort of thing on a body, that wasn't according to the rules. That was taking liberties.
Yes, there was more than one way to keep a reputation.
"I think we should go and explain things to our lawyer friend," he said slowly.
"Right," said Mr. Tulip. "And then I'll rip his head off."
"That doesn't kill zombies."
"Good, because then he'll be able to see where I'm going to shove it."
"And then we'll pay another visit to that newspaper, when it's dark."
To get that picture, he thought. That was a good reason. It was a reason that you could tell the world. But there was another reason. That burst of darkness had frightened Mr. Pin to his shrivelled soul. A lot of memories had come pouring back all at once. Mr. Pin had made a lot of enemies, but that hadn't worried him until now because all his enemies were dead. But the dark light had fired off bits of his mind, and it had seemed to him that those enemies had not vanished from the universe, but had merely gone a long way away, from which point they were watching him. and it was a long way away, only from his point of view. From their point of view, they could reach out and touch him. What he wouldn't say, even to Mr. Tulip, was this. They'd need all the money from this job because, in a flash of dark, he'd seen that it was time to retire. Theology was not a field in which Mr. Pin had much knowledge. Despite accompanying Mr. Tulip to a number of the more well-designed temples and chapels, on one occasion to scrag a high priest who'd tried to double-cross Frank Nutboy Nabbs, but the little he had absorbed was suggesting to him that this might be the very best time to take a bit of an interest. He could send them some money, maybe, or at least return some of the stuff he'd taken. Hell, maybe he could start not eating beef on Tuesday or whatever it was you had to do. Maybe that would stop this feeling that the back of his head had just been unscrewed. He knew that would have to be later, though. Right now, the code allowed them to do one of two things. They could follow Slant's instructions to the letter, which would mean they'd maintain a reputation for efficiency, or they could scrag Slant and maybe a few bystanders and leave, perhaps setting fire to a few things on the way out. That was also news that got around. People would understand how upset they were. But first we'll... Mr. Pin stopped, and in a strangled voice said, "Is someone standing behind me?"
"No,"
said Mr. Tulip. "I thought I heard footsteps."
"No one here but us."
"Right. Right." Mr. Pin shuddered, straightened his jacket, and then looked Mr. Tulip up and down. "Clean yourself up a bit, will you? Sheesh, you're leaking dust."
"I can handle it," said Mr. Tulip. "Keeps me sharp. Keeps me alert."
Pin sighed. Mr. Tulip had amazing faith in the contents of the next bag, whatever it was, and it was usually cat flea powder cut with dandruff. "Force isn't going to work on Slant," he said. Mr. Tulip cracked his knuckles.
"Works on everyone," he said.
"No. A man like him will have a lot of muscle to call on," said Pin. He patted his jacket. "It's time Mr. Slant said hello to my little friend." A plank thumped down onto the crusted surface of the River Ankh. Shifting his weight with care and gripping the rope tightly in his teeth, Arnold sideways swung himself onto it. It sank a little in the ooze, but stayed, for want of a better word, afloat. A few feet away, the depression that had been left by the first sack landing in the river was already filling up with, for want of a better word, water. He reached the end of the plank, steadied himself, and managed to lasso the remaining sack. It was moving.
"He's got it!" shouted the duck man, who was watching from under the ridge. "Heave away, everybody!"
The sack came out of the muck with a sucking sound, and Arnold pulled himself aboard as it was dragged back to the bank.
"Oh, very well done, Arnold," said the duck man, helping him off the sodden sack and back onto his trolley. "I really doubted if the surface would support you at this stage of the tide."
"Bitter luck for me, eh, when that cart ran off me legs all them years ago," said Arnold sideways. "I'd have drowned else."
Coffin Henry slit the sacking with his knife and tipped the second lot of little terriers onto the ground, where they coughed and sneezed.
"One or two of the little buggers look done for," he said. "I'll give 'em mouth-to-mouth respiratoration, shall I?"
"Certainly not, Henry," said the duckman. "Have you no idea of hygiene?"
"Genu."
"You can't kiss dogs," said the duckman. "They would catch something dreadful."
The crew looked at the dogs that were clustering around their fire. How the dogs had landed in the river was something they didn't bother to wonder about. All sorts of things landed in the river. It was the kind of thing that happened all the time. The crew took a keen interest in floating things, but it was unusual to get this many all at once.
"Maybe it's been raining dogs," said altogether Andrews, who was being steered by the mind known as Curly. The crew liked Curly. He was easy to get along with. "I heard the other day that's been happening lately."
"You know what," said Arnold sideways. "What we ought to do, right, is get some stuff like wooden stuff and make a boat. We could get a lot more stuff if we had a boat."
"Ah, yes," said the duckman. "I used to mess about in boats when I was a boy."
"We could boat about in mess," said Arnold. "Same thing."
"Not exactly," said the duckman. He looked at the circle of steaming, retching dogs. "I wish Gaspode was here," he said. "He knows how to think about this sort of thing."
"A jar," said the apothecary carefully. "Sealed with wax," William repeated.
And you want an ounce each of oil of aniseed, oil of rampion, and oil of scalatine, said William.
I can do the first two, said the apothecary, looking at the little list he'd been given, but there is no such thing as a whole ounce of oil of scalatine in the city, you realize. It's $15 for enough to go on a pinhead. We've got about enough to fill a mustard spoon, and we have to keep that in a soldered lead box under water.
I'll take a pinhead's worth, then.
You'll never get it off your hands, you know. It isn't really for the average.
In a bottle, said William patiently, sealed with wax.
You won't even smell the other oils. What do you want them for?
Insurance, said William.
Oh, and after you've sealed it, wash off the bottle with ether, and then wash the ether off.
Is this going to be used for some illegal purpose? Said the apothecary. He caught William's expression.
Just interested, he added quickly.
When he'd gone to make up the order, William called in at a couple of other shops and bought a pair of thick gloves. When he returned, the apothecary was just bringing the oils to the counter. He held a small glass flask filled with liquid. Inside floated a much smaller phial.
The outer liquid's water, he said, pulling some plugs out of his nose. Take it carefully, if you don't mind. Drop it, and we can kiss our sinuses goodbye.
What does it smell of? Said William.
Well, if I said cabbage, said the apothecary, I wouldn't be saying the half of it.
Next, William went to his lodgings. Mrs. Arcanum was averse to boarders coming back to their rooms during the day, but at the moment William appeared to be outside her frame of reference, and she merely gave him a nod as he went upstairs. The keys were in the old trunk at the end of his bed. It was the one he'd taken to Hugglestone's. He'd kept it ever since, so that he could kick it occasionally. His checkbook was also in there. He took that, too. His sword rattled as his hand brushed against it. He'd enjoyed swordsmanship at Hugglestone's. It was in the dry. You were allowed to wear protective clothing, and no one attempted to stamp your face into the mud. He'd actually been the champion of the school, but this wasn't because he was much good. It was simply that most of the other boys were so bad. They approached the sport as they approached all others, in a great big, keen, screaming rush, using the sword as a sort of club. That meant that if William could avoid the first wild stroke, then he was going to win. He left the sword in the trunk. After some reflection, he pulled out one of his old socks and pulled it over the apothecary's bottle. Hurting people with broken glass wasn't part of the plan either. Peppermint. Not a bad choice, but they hadn't known what else was available, had they? Mrs. Arcanum was a great believer in net curtains, so that she could see out while outsiders couldn't see in. William lurked behind the ones in his room until he was certain that an indistinct shape amongst the rooftops opposite was a gargoyle. This wasn't natural gargoyle territory, any more than Gleam Street. The thing about gargoyles, he reflected as he stepped back and headed down the stairs, was that they didn't get bored. They were happy to stay and watch anything for days. But while they moved faster than people thought, they didn't move faster than people. He ran through the kitchen so quickly that he only heard Mrs. Arcanum gasp, and then he was through the back door and over the wall and into the alley beyond. Someone was sweeping it. For a moment, William wondered if it was a watchman in disguise, or even Sister Jennifer in disguise, but probably there was no one who'd disguise themselves as a gnoll. You'd have to strap a compost heap to your back to begin with. Gnolls ate almost everything. What they didn't eat, they collected obsessively. No one had ever studied them to find out why. Perhaps a carefully sorted collection of rotted cabbage stalks was a sign of big status in gnoll society.
"Hello, Mr. Word,"
croaked the creature, leaning on its shovel.
Hello,
snake."
"Ah, yes, thank you. Goodbye."
He hurried down another alley, crossed the street and found yet another alley. He wasn't sure how many gargoyles were watching him, but it took them some time to cross streets. How was it that the gnoll had known his name? It wasn't as though they'd met at a party or something. Besides, the gnolls all worked for Harry King. Well, they did say that the King of the Golden River never forgot a debtor. William ducked and dodged across several blocks, making as much use as he could of the alleys and walk-throughs and noisome courts. He was sure a normal person wouldn't be able to keep track of him, but then he'd be amazed if a normal person was following him. Mr. Vimes liked to refer to himself as a simple copper, just as Harry King thought of himself as a rough diamond. William suspected that the world was littered with the remains of those people who had taken them at their word. He slowed down and climbed some outside stairs, and then he waited. "You're a fool," said the internal editor. "Some people have tried to kill you. You're concealing information from the watch. You're mixing with strange people. You're about to do something that is going to get so far up Mr. Vimes's nose it will raise his hat. And why?" "Because it makes my blood tingle," he thought, "and because I'm not going to be used by anyone." There was a faint sound at the end of the alley, which might not have been heard by anyone who wasn't expecting it. It was the sound of something sniffing. William looked down and saw, in the gloom, a four-legged shape break into a trot while keeping its muzzle close to the ground. William measured the distance carefully. Declaring independence was one thing. Assaulting a member of the watch was a very different thing. He lobbed the fragile bottle so that it would land 20 feet ahead of the werewolf. Then he dropped from the stairs onto the top of a wall and jumped down onto a privy roof just as the glass broke with a puff inside the sock. There was a yelp and the sound of scrabbling claws. William jumped from the roof and onto another wall, inched along the top of it, and climbed down into another alley, and then he ran. It took 5 minutes, dodging into convenient cover and cutting through buildings to arrive at the livery stables. In the general bustle, no one took any notice of him. He was just another man coming to fetch his horse. The stall that might or might not have contained deep bone was occupied by a horse now. It looked down its nose at him.
"Don't turn around, Mr. Paperman,"
said a voice behind him. William tried to remember what had been behind him. Oh, yes, the hay lift, and huge bags of straw, plenty of room for someone to hide.
"All right," he said. "Hark, hark, the dogs do bark," said Deep Bone. "You must be mental." "But I'm on the right track," said William. "I think I've... Here, you sure you weren't followed?" "Corporal Nobbs was on my trail," said William, "but I shook him off." "Ha! Walking round the corner would shake off Nobby Nobbs." "Oh, no, he kept right up. I knew Vimes would have me tracked," said William proudly.
"By Nobbs?"
"Yes, obviously, in his werewolf shape."
There, he'd said it. But today was a day for shadows and secrets.
"A werewolf shape?" said Deep Bone flatly.
"Yes, I'd be grateful if you didn't tell anyone else."
"Corporal Nobbs?"
said Deep Bone, still in the same dull monotone.
"Yes, look, Vimes told me not to..."
"Vimes told you Nobby Nobbs was a werewolf?"
"Well, no, not exactly. I worked that out for myself, and Vimes told me not to tell anyone else."
"About Corporal Nobbs being a werewolf?"
"Yes."
"Corporal Nobbs is not a werewolf, mister, in any way, shape or form. Whether he's human is another matter, but he ain't a bloody werewolf, that's for sure."
"Then whose nose did I just drop a scent bomb in front of?" said William triumphantly.
There was a silence, and then there was the sound of a thin trickle of water.
"Mr. Bone," said William. "What kind of scent bomb?"
said the voice. It sounded rather strained.
"I think oil of scalatine was probably the most active ingredient." "Right in front of a werewolf's nose?" "More or less, yes." "Mr. Vimes is gonna go round a twist," said the voice of Deep Bone. "He's gonna go totally librarian poo. He's gonna invent new ways of being angry just so he can try 'em out on you."
"Then I'd better get hold of Lord Veterinary's dog as soon as possible," said William. He produced his checkbook. "I can give you a check for $50, and that's all I can afford."
"What's one of them, then?"
"It's like a legal IOU."
"Oh, great," said Deep Bone. "Not much good to me when you're locked up, though."
"Right now, Mr. Bone, there's a couple of very nasty men hunting down every terrier in the city, by the sound of it."
"Terriers?"
said Deep Bone.
"All terriers?"
"Yes, and while I don't expect you to..."
"Like pedigree terriers, or just people who might happen to look a bit terrier-like?"
They didn't look like they were inspecting any paperwork.
"Anyway, what do you mean, people who look like terriers?"
Deep Bone went silent again. William said,
$50, Mr. Bone."
At length, the sacks of straw said,
"All right. Tonight, on the Misbegot Bridge, just you. I won't be there, but there will be a messenger." "Who shall I make the check to?"
said William. There was no answer. He waited a while, and then eased himself into a position where he could peer around the sacks. There was a rustling from them. Probably rats, he thought, because certainly none of them could hold a man. Deep Bone was a very tricky customer. Some time after William had gone, looking surreptitiously into the shadows, one of the grooms turned up with a trolley and began to load up the sacks. One of them said, "Put me down, mister." The man dropped the sack and then opened it cautiously. A small terrier-like dog struggled out, shaking itself free of clinging wisps. Mr. Hobson did not encourage independence of thought and an inquiring mind, and at 50 pence a day plus all the oats you could steal, he didn't get them. The groom looked owlishly at the dog.
"Did you just say that?" he said. "Course not," said the dog. "Dogs can't talk. Are you stupid or something? Someone's playing a trick on you. Gottlergear. Vigviano."
"You mean like throwing their voice? I saw a man do that down at the music hall."
"That's a ticket. Hold on to that thought."
The groom looked around.
"Is that you playing a trick, Tom?" he said.
"That's right. It's me, Tom," said the dog. "I got the trick out of a book. Throwing my voice into this harmless little dog what cannot talk at all."
"What? You never told me you were learning to read?"
"There were pictures," said the dog hurriedly. "Tongues and teeth and that. Dead easy to understand. Oh, now the little dog is wandering off."
The dog edged its way to the door.
"Sheesh," it appeared to say. "A couple of thumbs and they're lords of bloody creation."
Then it ran for it.